The headlines: Hamas says Israeli home demolitions will encourage Palestinians to fight to get back every inch of their land as the military blows up the house of a prisoner. President Biden announces a new military aid package for Ukraine worth $150 million. Plus, North Korea fires what its neighbors say was a ballistic missile as the U.S. warns an imminent nuclear test is on the cards. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmati and these are our top stories this hour. Israeli forces have attacked a group of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. A young man was injured and rushed to hospital. The Palestinians were angry at the destruction of the home of a prisoner in Jenin. Omar Jaradat was detained in December last year on charges of involvement in an operation that left an Israeli dead. Recently, an Israeli court ordered the demolition to go ahead. A senior member of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the move. Azat Arashka said that Israeli insistence on continuing its crimes will not bring security to its regions. He warned that the demolition of homes will only enhance the determination of Palestinians to resist the occupier and get back every inch of their land. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has denounced Israel's repeated attack on Al-Aqsa Mosque and Palestinian worshippers, blaming the intensifying violence on normalization with the regime. Saeed Khatibzadeh called on the Islamic countries to maintain unity to defend Palestinian and Al-Aqsa. That is the third holiest site to Muslims. Khatibzadeh said occupiers are now declining, adding that the Palestinian people have the legitimate right to fight Israel's occupation of their land. He called on regional countries and the international community to help Palestinians in their fight. Over the past few weeks, Israeli forces have on various occasions attacked Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque and the occupied Al-Quds. Hundreds have been injured as a result. Palestinians, in return, have stepped up retaliatory attacks against Israelis. And the Israeli regime has launched a massive manhunt for the Palestinians behind an attack in the Israeli city of Elad. The operation has also far drawn strong support from Palestinian resistance movements and threats from Israelis. However, no group has yet claimed responsibility for what many are calling a, quote, heroic act.
Two Palestinians have carried out a retaliatory operation in the central Israeli city of Elad, where several casualties were reported. The operation came hours after Israeli forces attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque to make way for hundreds of settlers to enter the holy site in Al-Quds. Over a dozen Palestinians were injured and many more arrested in the raid on Thursday. The retaliation also coincides with the Nakba, the anniversary of the illegal creation of Israel. Palestinian resistance movements have praised the operation as a natural response to Israeli crimes.
Operation Elad is part of the public display of our people's anger at the invasion of our sanctuaries by the occupiers. Today's operation goes in line with the resistance's warning that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line.
We hail the successful and heroic operation in occupied Al-Quds and remind Israel that our people will respond to the regime's crimes.
President Mahmoud Abbas, however, condemned the operation and warned against the Israelis making this incident a pretext to target the Palestinians. The operation comes against the backdrop of the regime's intensified acts of violence across the occupied West Bank, including targeting Muslim worshippers at Al-Aqsa. Over the past weeks, tensions have been running high at the mosque compound due to incursions by Israeli settlers protected by regime forces. Hundreds of Palestinians have been injured in the latest attacks. Dozens have been arrested.
An occupying force cannot continuously trample on the rights of the subjugated people, trample on their religious beliefs, basically wipe their feet on sacred shrines, and expect that this people will simply lay down and continue to take it without responding.
As a consequence of Israel's atrocities, the Palestinians have ramped up retaliatory attacks in Israeli cities. An Israeli minister has said the regime suffered a very heavy price in the Elad operation. And now Israel has once again revved up its crackdown machine against the Palestinians through arresting dozens of people and closing the crossings to the West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip, actions that will undoubtedly escalate the already tense circumstances in the occupied territories.
Russia says it has no intention of using nuclear weapons in the war with Ukraine. The foreign ministry slams as, quote, deliberate lies, reports by Western media suggesting the possibility of a nuclear strike by Moscow.
As I have already said, we have repeatedly had to refute insinuations about Russia's possible use of nuclear weapons in the course of its special military operation in Ukraine. This is a deliberate lie. Russia firmly adheres to the principle that there can be no winners in a nuclear war.
Zaitsev said Russia's use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine is ruled out since it is not in line with the objectives of its military operation there. Russia's ambassador to Washington has also reacted to the Western accusations. Anatoly Antonov says such, quote, baseless allegations are part of a propaganda campaign against Russia. The diplomat also accused the West of misinterpreting Moscow's recent decision to place its nuclear forces on high alert. He said the move was in response to extremely confrontational statements by Western countries that possess nuclear weapons. The United States has announced a new weapons package worth $150 million for Ukraine to use in its war with Russia. President Joe Biden said the package will provide additional artillery munitions, radars, and other equipment. The U.S. had already sent more than $3.4 billion worth of weaponry to Ukraine. Biden has warned that the current funding is running out and urged Congress to authorize more. He wants the chamber to authorize a huge $33 billion Ukraine package that includes $20 billion in military aid. The U.S. and its allies continue to supply arms to Ukraine despite repeated warnings by Russia to stop that. Moscow has warned of unpredictable consequences if Ukraine gets more weapons. Journalist and political commentator Dmitry Zolotarev says the U.S. is helping its own manufacturers by supplying weapons to Ukraine.
Russia emphasized that it has to save as many civilian population of Ukraine as possible. And the slow moving of Russian army through Ukraine is explained only by that. Because if Russia followed the United States or Great Britain or NATO, should I say NATO rules, it would shell the whole territory of Ukraine, glass it flat, and the whole war would be over in a couple of days, like I said long before. So sending the crew weapons to Ukraine is only about making lots of profit to the United States and about the deterioration of economic situation inside the United States. And Biden administration is trying hard to create the situation of military contracts inside the United States to increase the military plans to supply more weapons.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. Japan and South Korea say the North has fired a ballistic missile into the sea off its coast. Southern Korean military believes that the projectile was a short-range submarine-launched missile. On Wednesday, both countries also said North Korea had fired a ballistic missile. Pyongyang has not commented on both launches, but in recent weeks it has announced plans to build up its arsenal and even spoke of a preemptive nuclear strike to counter hostile forces. The North says its nuclear and missile program is for self-defense against U.S.-led threats in the region. Washington has recently assessed that Pyongyang could be ready to conduct a nuclear test as early as this month. To discuss that further, we're joined by Andrew Leung, independent China specialist who's joining us live from Hong Kong, and also Emmanuel Pasrich, president of the Asia Institute from Seoul. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us. Let's begin with Mr. Leung. What, in your opinion, is prompting North Korea to speed up its ballistic missile tests in recent weeks? Does it have anything to do with the war in Ukraine and Pyongyang's concerns about a future military conflict in Asia?
Well, there are several aspects to this. First of all, there is no doubt that Kim Jong-un is entirely fed up with so-called negotiations with the United States because the U.S. is seen to be unable or unwilling for any sort of compromise, always insisting on North Korea giving up all its defenses before they could even consider some sort of a compromise. So I think that the Kim Jong-un is completely fed up with that and likely to begin any negotiations with the United States anytime soon. Secondly, Kim Jong-un is learning, taking a leaf from President Putin's book over Ukraine because the possession of nuclear weapons is an effective deterrent to any direct military confrontation. So to guard against its own national security, North Koreans are embarking on possession of nuclear weapons together with this advanced delivering systems, so they're able to not to be coerced by the United States. I think that this also raises a third very important global dimension, which is that the United States can no longer call the shots in all circumstances, whether it's Ukraine with a direct kind of military confrontation or other areas like in Asia over North Korea, because the United States is increasingly exposing its hypocrisy, so-called U.S.-led liberal order, because it's neither liberal when it chooses to as regards to its immigrants. It is also selective in the embracing of authoritative regimes, embracing some, but also sanctioning others. Thirdly, it is not immune from using dirty or hypocritic coercive measures for unilateral for the selfish gains. So I think that there is a gradual erosion of the credibility of the U.S.-led liberal order, that the United States is seen to be able to dictate what kind of ideology, what kind of rules the rest of the world should follow. Also, there's another dimension that the United States, in terms of population, even together with its Western allies in Europe, only accounts for 8% of the world's population. So I think that most of the world, including the developing world, do not see why the whole world order should just follow a one-size-fits-all formula dictated by only a small minority of the world. So I think that the North Koreans are seeing through all this and its intent to developing its own deterrence, even including nuclear weapons, to gain back its control over its own sovereignty and national defense.
Okay, so Mr. Pasrich, we just heard Mr. Leung's explanations. How likely do you think North Korea is to conduct a nuclear test soon? We've heard the United States warning that Pyongyang is preparing for an underground test this month.
Right. Well, I don't have sufficient information, and I'm not a fortune teller, so I can't give a percentage. However, I would say based on what happened before, some 7 years ago, that it's entirely possible, and there are certain incentives to conduct a nuclear test. First, the United States, as Dr. Leung had suggested, is in a particularly difficult situation, especially both globally and also specifically in, with Ukraine and the confrontation with Russia. So it's not really in a position to attack North Korea or even to really threaten any further North Korea. Moreover, and this is the more, I say, the more dangerous part, is there's an incentive for North Korea's development of weapons, of these submarine-launched intercontinental ballistic missiles and other new technology, is part of a larger arms race in Asia, which simplistically you could say, well, it's the U.S. and its allies versus North Korea and China, but this is obviously not the case. All these countries, from Indonesia and South Korea, Vietnam, China, North Korea, Japan, etc., are all building up their militaries, and there's extremely high danger that this regional arms race will spin out of control. So I think the risk of a test is high, but it's not 100%, and that we really need to start thinking seriously about real solutions. And the only real solution is arms control treaties and disarmament treaties.
Thanks to both of you gentlemen for sharing your views with us on this edition of the News Review. Moving on, Sri Lankan protesters are back on the streets in the capital, Colombo, in defiance of a state of emergency, calling on their government to step down. The protesters gathered outside President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's office and the residence of his brother, who is the prime minister. They blame the government for a worsening economic crisis that has caused food, fuel, and medicine shortages. Similar protests took place outside Parliament on Friday when police used tear gas to disperse the crowds. Also on Friday, Sri Lankans staged a nationwide strike that brought the country to a standstill. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. The Eurozone faces concurrent economic shocks from the conflict in Ukraine and a surge in food and energy prices exacerbated by the conflict, along with a supply shock from China's zero-COVID policy. The article you're about to hear has been written by CNBC journalist Elliot Smith. The article has been published by CNBC and is titled, "We See a Big Recession in the Making. Top CEOs are fearing the worst in Europe." The Eurozone faces concurrent economic shocks from the conflict in Ukraine and a surge in food and energy prices exacerbated by the conflict, along with a supply chain shock from China's zero-COVID policy. Stefan Hartung, the chief executive officer of German engineering and technology giant Bosch, told CNBC that the company sees a big recession in the making in Europe. The CEOs of several European blue-chip companies have told CNBC that they see a significant recession coming down the pike in Europe. The European continent is particularly vulnerable to the fallout from the Russia-Ukraine conflict, associated economic sanctions and energy supply concerns. And economists have been downgrading economic growth forecasts for the Eurozone in recent weeks. The Eurozone faces concurrent economic shocks from the conflict in Ukraine and a surge in food and energy prices exacerbated by the conflict, along with a supply shock arising from China's zero-COVID policy. That has prompted concerns about stagflation, an environment of low economic growth and high inflation, and eventual recession. "For sure, we see a big recession in the making, but that's exactly what we see. It's in the making. There is still an overhanging demand because of the COVID crisis we just are about to leave," said Stefan Hartung, the chief executive officer of German engineering and technology giant Bosch. Stefan Hartung added, "It's still there and you see it heavily hitting us in China, but you see that in a lot of areas in the world and demand of consumers has already even been increased in some areas." In particular, Stefan Hartung noted lingering consumer demand for household appliances, power tools and vehicles, but suggested this would dissipate. "That means for a certain amount of time, this demand will still be there, even while we see the interest increase and we see the pricing increase, but at some point in time, it won't be just a supply crisis, it will also be a demand crisis. And then for sure, we are in a deep recession," he added. Inflation in the Eurozone hit a record high of 7.5% in March. So far, the European Central Bank has remained more dovish than its peers, such as the Bank of England or the US Federal Reserve, both of which have begun hiking interest rates in a bid to rein in inflation. However, the European Central Bank, the ECB, now expects to conclude net asset purchases under its asset purchase program in the third quarter, after which it will have room to begin monetary tightening, depending on the economic outlook. Berenberg chief economist Holger Schmeiding said in a note on Friday, 6th of May, that near-term risks to economic growth are tilted to the downside in Europe. Worsening Chinese lockdowns and cautious consumer spending in reaction to high energy and high food prices could easily cause a temporary contraction in Eurozone gross domestic product GDP in the second quarter, Schmeidling said. An immediate embargo on gas imports from Russia, which is highly unlikely, could turn that into a more serious recession. If the US Federal Reserve gets it badly wrong and catapults the US straight from boom to bust, unlikely but not impossible, such a recession could last well into next year. Yet, Holger Schmeiding suggested that the Eurozone is likely to enter recession only if worse came to the worst, and that it isn't a base expectation. Mark Branson, president of the German financial regulator BaFin, said any military escalation in Ukraine or further energy supply disruption could pose serious risk to economic growth in Europe's largest economy, with industrial sectors particularly vulnerable. We are already seeing that growth is down to around 0% in many jurisdictions, including here, and it's vulnerable. It's also vulnerable from the ongoing COVID-related shocks, he said. Mark Branson, the president of the German financial regulator BaFin, added, "We've got inflation that's going to need to be tackled, and it's going to need to be tackled now, so that's a cocktail which is difficult for the economy." Slavomir Krupa, deputy chief executive officer of Societe Generale, told CNBC on Thursday that the French lender is monitoring the macroeconomic picture closely. "It's obviously a fundamental piece of news for that macroeconomic context and a triggered inflation feedback loop between the energy shock, which was already going on before the conflict in Ukraine. You have the inflation expectation rising and the risk of a final fundamental impact on the macroeconomy into a recession," he said, adding that this would potentially affect the entire system and Societe Generale as well. Ola Kalinius, the chief executive officer of Mercedes-Benz, also told CNBC last week that the situation in China and the conflict in Ukraine are making for a challenging business environment for the German luxury automaker Mercedes-Benz in three distinct ways. "On the one hand, we've had the ongoing shortages mainly associated with semiconductors. On top of that, there are now new lockdowns in China, our biggest market, which will affect us in China, but also can affect supply chains across the world. And in addition to that, of course, the conflict in Ukraine. So the business environment is challenging," he explained. Ola Kalinius's comments were echoed by Volkswagen chief executive officer Herbert Diess, who told CNBC on Thursday that the company also faced a challenging environment from COVID, the chip shortage, and the conflict in Ukraine in the first quarter. The chief executive officer of Maersk, Søren Skou, said on Thursday, 5th of May, that the world's largest shipping company, Maersk, is also keeping an eye on recession risks, particularly in the United States, but does not expect those to come to the fore until late 2022 or early 2023.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Palestinians have launched yet another retaliatory operation in an Israeli city, this time killing three Israelis in El Ard. Resistance groups have hailed the move as a heroic act and a natural response to Israel's crimes. This follows Thursday's storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied Al-Quds by Israeli settlers and forces. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll look at why Israel keeps raising tensions through its aggression against the Muslim holy sites. And what message does such Palestinian operations send to Israel?
Two Palestinians have carried out a retaliatory operation in the central Israeli city of Eilat, where several casualties were reported. The operation came hours after Israeli forces attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque to make way for hundreds of settlers to enter the holy site in Al-Quds. Over a dozen Palestinians were injured and many more arrested in the raid on Thursday. The retaliation also coincides with the Nakba, the anniversary of the illegal creation of Israel. Palestinian resistance movements have praised the operation as a natural response to Israeli crimes.
Operation Eilat is part of the public display of our people's anger at the invasion of our sanctuaries by the occupiers. Today's operation goes in line with the resistance's warning that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line.
We hailed the successful and heroic operation in occupied Al-Quds and remind Israel that our people will respond to the regime's crimes.
President Mahmoud Abbas, however, condemned the operation and warned against the Israelis making this incident a pretext to target the Palestinians. The operation comes against the backdrop of the regime's intensified acts of violence across the occupied West Bank, including targeting Muslim worshippers at Al-Aqsa. Over the past weeks, tensions have been running high at the mosque compound due to incursions by Israeli settlers protected by regime forces. Hundreds of Palestinians have been injured in the latest attacks. Dozens have been arrested.
An occupying force continuously trample on the rights of a subjugated people, trample on their religious beliefs, wipe their feet on sacred shrines, and expect that this people will simply lay down and continue to take it without responding.
As a consequence of Israel's atrocities, the Palestinians have ramped up retaliatory attacks in Israeli cities. An Israeli minister has said the regime suffered a very heavy price in the Eilat operation. And now Israel has once again revved up its crackdown machine against the Palestinians through arresting dozens of people and closing the crossings to the West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip, actions that will undoubtedly escalate the already tense circumstances in the occupied territories.
Well, joining us on this edition of Spotlight, we have Professor of Political Science at Beer Sheva University, Mr. Saad Nimr, joining us from Ramallah. And author and journalist Robert Fantina joining us from Kitchener, Ontario.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Professor Nimr in Ramallah. We've seen several reprisal attacks against Israelis over the past few weeks, some in the heart of Tel Aviv, the recent one in the city of Eilat, which killed three people. Give us your perspective on the significance of these recent events as Palestinians are showing their anger at the regime's crimes and occupation.
Good evening for you and all your viewers and also to your guest in Ontario. It's quite clear that this is a kind of a natural reaction by the Palestinians to the atrocities committed by the Israeli this Zionist colonialist regime. As far as they are continuing with their actions against the Palestinians, including the land grabbing, the settlers attacking and building more settlements, and on top of all, Jerusalem and the ethnically cleansing of Jerusalem and the attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque in an attempt to divide it both-wise, time and place, for the Jews to use it as well as the Muslim, as it happened in Al Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron. As far as these atrocities are continuing, definitely there will be a resistance. And I won't say it's quite natural. I would say it came even a little bit late. The Palestinians were waiting and waiting and waiting for anything to happen, for some of you know, the international community even to interfere. But apparently not. So they have to take all things in their own hands. And this campaign, operations starting more than 1 month ago and during Ramadan also, it came as a reaction to the Israeli actions against the Palestinians. And as we said once before, and I'm saying it again, we expect even more escalation in these operations and more, you know, attacks by the Palestinians and more attacks by the Israelis. And things are going for more of escalation in the coming few weeks and maybe months. So it might be a kind of a new wave of intifada in a different, face, in a different shape. But it is a kind of a reaction by the Palestinians to resist this occupation, which is something that had an effect on the Israeli side. If we look today at the reaction by the Israelis, it is absolutely stunning. You know, Ehud Barak, the previous prime minister, is saying that he's afraid that the end of Israel is coming within this coming next 10 years or less. Start to discuss that the settlers' actions in Al-Aqsa Mosque is aggravating the Palestinians, and that why they have these operations. So there is a kind of a discussion even among the Israeli society about what's going on, and they all feel that the security system in Israel is not adequate enough to predict or even to stop these kind of operations, which they expect that is going to continue.
Robert Fantina, picking up on what our guest in Ramallah just mentioned, let's go over some of the reactions at this point. Hamas has pledged to defend Al-Aqsa at any price. Islamic Jihad has said Israel is responsible for the repercussions of its aggression. The Palestinian Authority has also reacted, saying that aggression against Al-Aqsa is equivalent to crossing all red lines. Observers and analysts, including Mr. Saad Nimr, who just spoke on the issue, say that if the attacks and the desecration of Al-Aqsa continues, we could be looking at the prelude for a third intifada. Do you see it in that light as well?
Yes, I do. And we have to look at these atrocities that have been committed by Israelis in the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the larger frame of the occupation in general. The people of Palestine have been suffering for decades under this occupation, and the actions that are currently that we're seeing now, the attacks of Palestinians against Israelis, are a natural outcome of it. We have to remember additionally that according to international law, an occupied people has the right, the internationally guaranteed right, to resist the occupation in any way possible, including armed struggle.
Professor Nim, how do you view the recent wave of violence against Palestinians that have been carried out by the Israeli regime against worshippers during the holy month of Ramadan and at the revered Al-Aqsa Mosque? Our Ramallah correspondent that we spoke to earlier believes that Israel is planning to split up Al-Aqsa Mosque in terms of time and space. What do you see as the reason behind this recent wave of Israeli aggression?
Yeah, Yanni, first of all, we have to understand that this is the nature of this government, and this is the nature of this colonial regime in general in Israel. And this government, particularly the Bennett government, Bennett himself is a settler, and he was the head of the settler council at some stage. So they are encouraging settlers to, having more land and try to Jewidize Jerusalem. And the most important thing in Jerusalem is the Al-Aqsa compound and Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Israeli were trying for the last more than 20 years, we are talking about, you know, after the year 2000 and the Second Intifada, to divide Al-Aqsa Mosque compound both wise time and space between the Palestinian Muslims and the Jews. And in an attempt to do so, they allowed these incursions into Al-Aqsa Mosque on a daily basis. Now, you know that at 7 o'clock in the morning till 11 o'clock in the morning, Palestinians are not allowed to go to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque or Al-Aqsa compound in general. And only settlers are allowed. And they try to, you know, sometimes do like what happened last Thursday when they wanted to raise the Israeli flag and they wanted to chant, you know, songs regarding what they call it, so-called the Independence Day, which is our Nakba Day. And definitely the Palestinians were there all night trying to resist this kind of move, and they managed to suppress them. In addition to the threats came from the Palestinian resistance from Gaza, that if they did so, things will be escalated. So what happened that the Israeli wanted now, more or less, we can say that time-wise, they managed to, you know, have their own time now, but they can't do anything yet, only just tours inside the compound. Now, what they are looking at is Bab al-Rahma, which is a part of Al-Aqsa Mosque, and they want to control this this area, and they claim this area, and they are trying to control it. And in this case, if they did, it will be the space dividing also, as it happened in Ibrahimi Mosque of Hebron when it happened after the 1994 massacre that happened in Ibrahimi Mosque. So sure. Because of that, this is something very sensitive to the Palestinians, very sensitive also to the Muslims. And we see that the reactions of the Muslim world and the Arab world is not to the level, you know, to prevent the Israel of doing things or to be a real threat to the Israelis. So Palestinians will take all these things into their hands and try to defend Al-Aqsa Mosque, as we saw during the Ramadan time and even after, to just send a strong message to Israel that don't go there.
Robert Fantina, top Hamas official Ismail Haniyeh says Palestinians have two options before them: submission to the Judaization of the Al-Aqsa Mosque or resistance against Israel, and they have chosen the latter. Now, many analysts say that resistance is the most viable option left for Palestinians. How important is this consistent resistance?
Consistent resistance is vitally important for the Palestinians. It's the only way they will achieve their rights, since the international community has chosen to ignore and neglect them. So the sustained resistance against the brutal illegal occupation is required. Part of the problem with the resistance is that Mahmoud Abbas, with his so-called security coordination with Israel, helps to stifle that resistance. So that has to stop. He's a traitor to the Palestinian people, in my view. But the resistance is the only way the Palestinians will get their freedom. It's the only, violence is the only language that Israel understands. Negotiations are pointless. Anything else that's done is really, sometimes it'll be armed resistance, sometimes it'll be forms of strikes, boycotts, and so on. But the Israeli regime has proven over and over again that it is not reasonable. It does not want to grant the Palestinians any rights. It does not respect international law. And so the people of Palestine must resist.
Saad Nimr, let's talk about the normalization deals. Palestinians have condemned these agreements as a betrayal of Jerusalem al-Quds. Many countries have said the Israeli regime has become more aggressive as a result of some Arab rulers abandoning the Palestinians and their cause. In your opinion, have these Arab governments turned a blind eye to the suffering of their Arab brethren? And has that emboldened the Israelis even more?
Well, yes, definitely, and especially when we are talking about those Arab countries which ran directly to the Israelis and normalized the relationship, such as the Emirates and Bahrain, in addition to other Arab countries such as Sudan and Morocco. This is, you know, like giving a green line to the Israeli to go ahead with all their atrocities. And notice that this normalization came during that period of Trump and the period of Netanyahu, which was a very right-wing government. And during Netanyahu's period, most of the, for more than 10 years, most of these enlarging settlements and grabbing of land and even the incursions on Al-Aqsa Mosque was continuing. And they yet, they have normalization relationship with Israel, which give them, you know, like a green line to say, yeah, we, you know, we don't care that much about the Palestinians. So this will encourage the Israelis to go ahead, knowing that the Arabs are not going to be with the Palestinians, or some of the Arabs, not all of them, though. But we know that the people in these countries not necessarily agreeing, and to the contrary, they are against, and we have witnessed some demonstrations in some of these countries against these kind of agreements and normalization, and the people generally are refusing. But we are talking about, you know, governments, and we are talking about, you know, authorities in these countries who are running and complying with the American request to normalize the relationship with Israel. Definitely this affects us. And however, regardless, even for the last more than 30 years, when these Arabs did something in reality, something effective to help the Palestinians, apart sometimes from, you know, sending some money or, you know, saying some condemnation to the Israeli actions, but in reality, they did nothing, you know, to help the Palestinian in such a way that would be effective against the Israeli measures. So what we are asking for is now that the Palestinian is taking their case in their own hands. And we hope now that people will support us in our struggle and our resistance to this occupation. Because okay, by the end of the day, I'm not talking about the occupation of 1967. I'm talking about this whole regime, Zionist racist regime, which was implanted since before 1948 and continue.
Okay, let's bring in Robert Fantina on the discussion as well. Are the U.S. and Israel trying to legitimize the occupation? Because if Arab governments are normalizing ties and aren't prioritizing the Palestinian cause for the region, then it'll be easier to get other countries to downplay it as well. Is that what's being done here?
Yes, it is what's being done. Any of those Arab countries that have formed alliances with Israel could have made certain conditions, could have made the alliance contingent on certain conditions, such as ending the blockade of Gaza, removing all illegal settlers, and recognizing the nation of Palestine. They did none of that. This is certainly in keeping with Donald Trump's policies toward Israel and Palestine, and President Joe Biden's policies are not much different. The idea is to minimize and marginalize the Palestinian people, ignore their rights, the right of return, all their right of self-determination, their basic right of self-determination, and thus giving Israel the green light to continue expanding its settlements, which it's doing now, another 4,000 settlements in the West Bank. It's giving it the green light to kill more Palestinians with complete impunity. It's a barbaric situation. The world is allowing it. The United States is financing it, and Israel is perpetuating it.
Mr. Fantina, I'm going to stay with you. How do you explain the clear inconsistency of the international response to the Ukraine conflict and the seven-decade-old occupation of Palestine? Why hasn't Israel been sanctioned and pressured and shunned by the international community to end its occupation of Palestine?
There are a couple of reasons for this. None of them positive. All of them terrible. One is that the occupation and the crimes against Palestine have become expected. People aren't shocked by them anymore. But another reason is racism. We've heard commentators from the BBC and from other respectable, if I can use that word, news outlets saying that about the Ukrainians, oh, these are white Christians. these are people who drive cars like us. These are people who look like us. This is just racism in its most blatant and ugly form. People suffer regardless of what they look like. We all suffer the same. We bleed the same. We grieve the same. This is just racism as we're seeing it manifested.
Saad Nim, last question to you. We're running short of time. Very briefly, if you may, do you think the Israelis have also taken advantage of global attention being on the Ukraine war? The Israelis, they already fly under the radar thanks to Western mainstream media, and now the focus of the world is already elsewhere.
Well, yes, they are using that, but generally speaking, you know, the Israelis, they don't care about the international community as far as they are having the backing of the United States particularly and the silence of the European Union and the other Western countries. So even so, you know, they don't care. Even if there is all the attention is on Palestine, it will be only condemnation. There isn't a real action by the international community, this hypocrite international community, exactly as your guest was saying about, you know, what's going on in Ukraine. So the Israeli, they don't care. And definitely they are using the attention now that it's focusing on somewhere else to do more even actions. But they usually don't care even about, you know, the attention, because they know that no one is going to do anything, because they believe that the Israelis, that Israel is a country above the international law.
Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University, Saad Nimr, joining us from Ramallah. Author and journalist Robert Fantina joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. Thank you for contributing to the program, and also thanks for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, Allah, Allah.
Today's great tip, what are the secrets of a heart in tranquility when it comes to our ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah?
Allah, 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 Allahu Rabbi, la sharika lahu.
Now, dear listeners, we are talking about tranquility of heart when it comes to our ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah. Now, one of the very important things that we are taught by the spiritual masters, the urafa, and we are taught by the teachers of akhlaq, these moral and ethical traits, one of the things that we are taught is this idea of a tranquil heart, a heart which is at peace. Now, we might think, well, what does our heart, and most specifically, the tranquility of our heart, have to do with our ubudiyah? So let me explain this to you via an example. You have one individual who sits in a classroom, but constantly they are thinking about something else. They are thinking about playing outside. They are thinking about what they're going to do at home. They're thinking about the homework that they didn't do. Or they're thinking about what video game they are going to play. Or perhaps they're thinking about, you know, that they're going to go get a haircut. This is one individual. Another individual who sits in the classroom is paying complete attention to the teacher. They are listening actively to what is happening in the classroom. They are paying attention to the lessons that the teacher is teaching. They are aware of what is going on inside the classroom. Now, the first individual who sat in the classroom and their mind was everywhere except the class, this kind of an individual is one who has a heart which is not in tranquility. The heart is disturbed. The heart is distracted. The heart is not at peace. The second individual who was paying attention in class and was totally absorbed in their classroom and what is being taught is a heart which is at ease, a heart which has tranquility. So you must now understand that when a heart is in tranquility, it is better able to benefit from the servitude and the worship and the obedience to Allah, which we refer to in this example as the classroom. The more the heart is tranquil, the less the heart is distracted, the more it can benefit from our ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com. Dear listeners of the program Foresight, my name is Muhammad. Today, I'm going to read to you the English translation of an excerpt from Munajatul Arifin. Please stay with me. نهاري دونكم ليل In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. My God, tongue